You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
I fell into pornography in the computer lab of my Christian school. By the time I was in college, university, it was just a part of my life, my life daily. And I could not for the life of me quit pornography. Everything in scripture lets us know that if you're having some visible problem, there's probably something invisible taking place that needs to be addressed first.
Dear young married couple, are you feeling a little stuck with your unwanted sexual behavior? Sometimes people get accountability filters, they get an accountability partner, but they still feel like they're not making progress around this issue.
So today we interview Sathya Sam. He is a coach and a speaker. He helps men live with confidence and integrity. He's a recovered addict himself, and he's the creator of a program that is research-based and Bible-backed. It's a system for overcoming porn addiction. It's called Deep Clean. We share a little bit more about that at the end of the episode. And he's also the author of a book called The Last Relapse. And his work has helped people from college students to medical doctors and everyone in between regain control of their lives and walk in greater levels of freedom.
So if you want to take a new look at this unwanted behavior and hopefully get at the root, listen today. It's going to be really good. Sathya Sam, so honored to have you on the podcast.
Honored to be here. And you pronounced my name right, man. Well done. Nailed it.
Yeah. Well, we're looking forward to our chat today. And before we start asking you questions, you know, from a professional or spiritual perspective, we'd like to hear a little bit about your story. So rewind back to wherever it makes sense and tell us a little bit about your story.
Sure. Yeah. So, nobody gets into the business of helping people quit pornography without a story usually. And so mine starts, you know, very young. I was a pastor's kid. Adam, I know you know all about that. My grandpa was a pastor. Even my great grandpa was a pastor. So it runs pretty deep in the family. Wow. Went to Christian school, you know, very involved at church. I had everything set up for me to have a pretty good life and make good decisions. Mm-hmm. And I fell into pornography in the computer lab of my Christian school. I was 11 years old. It was more or less innocent. You know, I had a guy come over. He's like, hey, my friend told me to check out this site. And it was very innocent sounding. And that was sort of the beginning of the end, as it were. I wasn't, you know, addicted overnight. It wasn't anything like that. It's just, it really planted a seed. I was pre-puberty. So I wasn't even really that interested in what I saw. I was kind of disturbed. But when the time came and the desires were aroused, I remembered, you know, and I went back to it. And that was the beginning. High school was kind of, there was some regularity to it. And by the time I was in college, university, it was just a part of my life, my life daily. And I sort of had one foot in the world, one foot kind of in Christ at that point. You know, growing up in church, I knew the stuff and I knew I wanted to live my life that way, but I was not fully committed. And I mentioned to you guys, I was a university researcher. I was working in the Faculty of Sciences in the most atheistic environment you can imagine.
Yep.
And becoming an adult, kind of making decisions about my faith and figuring out, why do I believe this stuff? And do I actually believe it? And in all that, I found Jesus, you know, and I really decided like, okay, my life is actually committed. I'm going to let go of the ways of the world and both feed in. And I knew with that decision, because of my upbringing, came a couple of lifestyle changes. You know, I had to drink more responsibly or not drink at all. I had to clean up my language and I had to quit watching porn. Those were like the three things top of the list that I always told myself I'll stop when I need to, kind of thing.
Right.
And the first two, no problem, you know, not a big deal. And I could not for the life of me quit pornography. And I always told myself I could. I was in denial about the extent of the issue. And that's sort of where my professional career kind of begins, because I realized, number one, how debilitating it was. Number two, how few conversations were being had around it. And number three, even fewer solutions that were out there to actually have people experience lasting freedom. So
yes,
that was sort of where everything started. I had two prayers while I was in this kind of recovery process, which was about 5 years altogether. And my first prayer was, God, if you set me free, I'll do everything else in my power to set as many other people free as well. And so, like I said, it was a journey. I would love to get into the details of it, but February 2016, I had my last relapse. I waited about 2.5 years before I launched Deep Clean, which is my coaching practice now. And the last 5.5 years or so, we've been able to help thousands of people around the world quit porn, walk in greater purity and freedom and integrity. And more importantly, you know, step into their God-given calling, which is often what gets kind of limited by unwanted sexual behavior and addictions and dysfunction and all of that. So it's been a lot of fun, but it was a long journey to get here.
Yeah. Well done. It is difficult to get free from that, especially when it's been a part of your life for so long.
When you're exposed early as well, it's not just that it's part of your life for so long, it's that you develop with it. And when something's a part of your development, that to separate and detach from it is really, really difficult.
Yeah. What was surprising to you? What was the stickiness of pornography and the surprising, like, solutions to work your, you know, to grow out of it?
I think the most surprising thing for me was how illogical the nature of porn addiction is. Because I'm a very brainy guy, like skipped grade 2, had my honors degree by the time I was 20. You know, like I was able to just logic myself into and out of anything I wanted up until that point. And I was also very routine and disciplined. So that was just where I naturally leaned when I started to recover. I just figured, yeah, it's probably going to be a couple of difficult weeks of white knuckling it. You know, very difficult for a brown guy to white knuckle it, but I still managed to pull it off. And still, you know, still like months later, I found myself just back in these addiction cycles. And that's when I was really surprised of like, wow, I'm actually ill-equipped to handle this, you know, and this is not as, it's just not as logical as I thought it was.
Huh. Okay. So being in a pastor's kid, being a pastor's kid and learning, okay, this isn't simple. Mm-hmm. What were the things that you had to do or learn in order to like get a foothold on getting yourself out of that?
Yeah, I would say probably three things. I think the first thing was acknowledging that I couldn't do it alone. It was a big pill for me to swallow. You know, I was just used to figuring it out, you know, so that was really difficult. It's the only reason I got free at the same time, you know, like I needed it, but it was really challenging. I think the second thing, I'm trying to think this through a little bit. I think the second thing was realizing that there's no timeline attached to it. You know, like I'm sure people come to you guys as well and they're like, okay, how long is this going to take? And like, just give me the stuff and I'll do the stuff. And then in 3 months I'm good to go. And I was definitely of that mindset. So I think just accepting like this is a process, it's very nuanced, it's very individualized, and I have to be able to embrace my own journey. And I think the third thing was acknowledging that God was not in a rush for me to get free, you know, which sounds a little bit controversial, but there's just certain things that you can only learn through your trials and working through your stuff that you can't gain any other way. And I just know that if I wouldn't have learned them then, I would have had to relearn them again later when my life is more complicated. I'm married now, I have a kid. And so God was not in any hurry to deliver me or set me free. Even though it's what he wanted, you know, he was very content being alongside me in the journey. And those were all big paradigm shifts for me.
That's good. What comes to mind when you say that is that faith without works is dead. And so while he does the healing work, he wants you to actually put work in too.
Yeah. People, you know, I'm from like a more charismatic background spiritually, where people love the deliverance stuff. And I'm a big fan of it as well. I think it's amazing.
Yeah.
But at the same time, people often have this sort of microwaved approach to matters of the heart, and it just doesn't work that way. You know, we know that anecdotally, but we know that even biblically, heart transformation really does take its time and usually takes longer than we want it to. And that's actually a really good thing, you know, like that's God's design and it makes us better. And with it comes character, you know, it's perseverance that produces character. Character produces hope. All of those things come on a longer time scale. And so I'm really grateful in hindsight. It wasn't always easy at the time.
Okay. So speaking of timelines, you know, you have the people, and we've all seen it in our work with people, that they get found out and they do the work and they are really aligned spiritually and they never relapse again. Then you have the people who relapse. You mentioned that you had a relapse, you know, and you know, they're learning things over time and it's a longer process, but they get free from pornography.
Yeah.
And then you also have the people, and this is where my question comes in, who are putting the work in. They are doing quote unquote the right things. You know, they're getting accountability, going to groups. They're spiritually aligned. At least they think so. And then they're doing the inner child work. They're trying to heal the wounds of their past. And they're quote unquote relapsing every few days. Like, yeah. As in, have they ever actually healed or been treated from pornography? Talk a little bit about that third person.
So, okay, I'll talk about the second person first, if that's okay, because it'll give some context for the third.
Sure.
The whole premise of what we do is we are convicted that all behavior is rooted in belief and that everything starts internal and then external. And I think what happens in these conversations, typically, most of the solutions are externally focused. It's, you have the bad behavior, let's modify the behavior. And that's the same thing as running over a weed with a lawnmower. So everything looks neat and tidy for a little bit, but as long as the root system is there, it's going to grow back. So for people that are in that second category, where like maybe they've had some progress, they're doing the stuff, and you know they just can't seem to break free or get fully where they want to go. Mm-hmm. Usually there's some remnants of the roots, and we can talk about what that might mean. I think when you have people who are doing everything right and it just feels like no progress is happening, my inclination as a coach typically is to simplify, because typically what's happened is recovery's become an idol at that point. And no matter what you do, you end up serving the wrong God. So I really like to simplify. I like to reduce. And this is what we always ask people when they are plateaued in general, but definitely someone in that situation, is what is working? Let's do more of that. What's not working? Let's get rid of it. Mm-hmm. And I would take more extreme measures with somebody who's in a situation like that, because it's probably necessary for them to be able to reorient themselves and get back on the right path.
That's really good. Yeah. Okay. So talk a little bit more about the idol of treatment, the idol of recovery. Like, what do you mean by that? I love this concept.
Yeah. I think just about anything can become an idol, rather, in this conversation. Like even purity, like if you look at purity culture and sort of the breakaway from that, a lot of people had made an idol out of, you know, preserving their virginity and, you know, certain behaviors. And it was a lot more about the goal of purity, or it's more about the goal of recovery than it is about becoming more Christ-like.
Yeah.
And I think this happens a lot because people get so in their heads about their recovery, especially if you're not dealing with the shame. And yeah, people end up being more excited to recover than they do about serving God more wholeheartedly, becoming more like Him. And I think when you reverse those things, the neat thing is if you actually make it your number one priority to become more like Christ, you naturally start to deviate from the things of the world, the things like pornography and whatever else. Your appetites literally begin to change and your self-control begins to increase as well. And so I think it's easy to fall into it because we all have goals. We all have ambitions. You know, if you have a marriage on the line, how could recovery not become the biggest thing that you need to do to get it in order?
Right.
But we really try hard to make sure everything stays in perspective, because as long as recovery is like the only thing you're focused on, you're just not going to get the goals you want.
Mm.
That's solid.
So good.
Yeah.
What do we do about the root when you just, you know, run over it with the lawnmower? How do you get to that root?
Yeah, I mean, everything comes from the heart. You know, Jesus said in Luke 6:45, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. Proverbs 4:23 says, guard your heart, for from it flow the issues of life. Like everything in scripture lets us know that if you're having some visible problem, there's probably something invisible taking place that needs to be addressed first. Mm-hmm. And that's where the roots lie. I think what makes it difficult is because it's invisible, you don't always know. Like you don't always know if it's effective or if it's the right thing. It's a lot easier to say, I installed the internet filter, or I'm praying 30 minutes every day in the morning.
Check.
Like, yeah, exactly. I'm good to go. And we can all applaud that and say like, well done. It looks like everything's in order. Mm, when in reality, you know, if you are having, you know, some, I don't know, maybe you're going to pornography for comfort. Mm-hmm. Well, if you're praying in a way that gets comfort from God, then your prayer life is actually going to be really useful for you to get free. Mm-hmm. But if you're just bringing forth your petitions and your requests, you're going through the motions, you can pray till you're blue in the face. It's probably not going to actually get to the real root of the issue.
That's so, so good.
Really good.
Yeah.
Because like so if you have a different view of God, like if God has a stick in his hand rather than a hug, it's not going to solve the comfort issue for you.
Yeah. And then typically what happens is without, again, I don't know how people do it without God, but if you don't have God, you end up getting these unmet needs just met through a more either covert or socially acceptable manner, right? Like that's the whole nature of it. It's like you have unmet needs. These unmet needs drive you to meet those needs. And if you're not taught properly, it will be unhealthy. And if it's something as toxic as pornography, it becomes addictive. Yeah. And your path to recovery involves uncovering those needs, labeling them, and then finding superior and healthy ways to get them met, which generally is going to involve God one way or the other. And without that, because really only God's the person who can properly meet those needs, then you end up gravitating towards something else. You know, we've seen people who like come to us and they're like, hey, I don't think I need your program because I haven't watched porn in 2 years, but I just really struggle with masturbation. It's like, well, you know, like we can have a conversation about whether that's right or wrong, but if you've replaced one compulsive behavior with the other, it doesn't really matter because ultimately the roots are still there, right? Mm-hmm.
So what did Sathya learn as about himself? As what his roots look like, and how did you solve your situation?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I would say there's three primary things, and this is kind of the bedrock of our system that we walk guys through. So the first is I was totally emotionally inept. I was, you know, I was as numb as they get. And I lost 3 friends to suicide in high school. And, you know, pastor's kid, Indian culture, like everything basically said, emotions equals bad, you know, keep them at bay.
Yeah.
So that was sort of my mantra. I actually remember, I lost 3 friends, but one friend in particular was really close. And I was 14 years old. And I remember when he passed away, I made this vow in my heart, I will not cry. I will not cry over this. To me, that for some reason, that was like the most noble thing I could do to handle the situation. So just to give you an idea of how numb I was. So that was the first thing. I still remember one of my mentors when she called me out and she's like, you have no idea. Like, you don't even know what an emotion is. And I was like, really? You know, like I was totally blindsided by it. And so like every day she would ask me, like, she wouldn't ask me, how's it going? Or how are you doing? She would say, hey, how are you feeling? How are you feeling? You know, just day in, day out, like just implanting that language and forcing me to think about, yeah, how am I feeling? You know? Mm-hmm. So that was a big thing. And that, you know, we kind of blanket that now in our program as emotional fitness or self-awareness. To me, that's like sort of the gateway to any kind of growth or development. The second piece is really recovering from parts of the past. And so I would say I had a couple, like I had a good childhood, but I did have dynamics growing up that left me feeling neglected. And it's not that my parents were neglectful physically, but emotionally there wasn't always I wasn't getting my needs met the way I needed them to be met when I was younger. And especially from my mom. And so that maternal wound naturally just gravitated towards pornography and chasing girls and all that stuff. Cause I was just trying to fill that need ultimately.
Can I slow you down right there? Cause please. I think that that's really helpful for you just to like talk about. But you said it so easily.
Yeah.
And I've met a lot of people and worked with a lot of people that's sacred ground.
Yeah.
You know,
especially as a pastor.
Because when
kid,
they look at their family, they go like, I had a good childhood. Why are you guys focusing on childhood? Why are you guys focusing on all this stuff? Because my childhood was good. Must be something else. I must be broken, right? And they don't want to look at their family because they had a good family.
Yes.
Can you talk to that person just a little bit?
Yeah. Well, for starters, I'll just say I get it because I would say the first couple years that I heard this kind of messaging, I totally resisted it. Or I didn't even resist it. I just kind of wrote it off like, no, I'm good because my parents were good. We didn't have any crazy dysfunction. I think there's a difference between blame and ownership, and the line can get very blurry, especially in our day and age, because we do actually see people who are, you know, talking about their parent dynamics and they're actually just blaming them. And they fall into this paradigm of like, oh, I would have had such a utopic life if not for my parents, you know, like if they didn't do X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
I think addressing your parents' shortcomings, number one, nobody's perfect. But number two, we want to do it out of curiosity. We want to do it out of a place where we're just trying to understand our own experiences better. That's good. I think if we do that with the right language, with the right approach and mentality, it can actually be really beneficial on both ends. And so there's a difference between saying, you know, like my mom was a neglectful person and that's why I got caught up in pornography. That's different blame. Than saying, that would be blame. Exactly. And that's different than my mom's or than saying, you know, my mom wasn't able to meet some of my needs that I had growing up. And because of it, I turned to other things like pornography. So you're still describing what took place, but you're still making sure that the focus is on your side of it, your experience. We're not letting other people control our narratives. So does that help? Does that make sense?
I think it does. And I think just going at it with truth in mind and curiosity, that's one of my favorite words, actually, working with people. It's just being curious to look at what you've gone through. And curiosity isn't so quick to label or to shame. It's just like, okay, this is what is. Yeah. It's getting to the root.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yep. Exactly. And without that curiosity, you don't get a chance to fully understand yourself. Because like we're so complex, and without you asking questions or someone asking you questions and having that freedom to explore, it's really, really challenging to actually, you know, get a comprehensive picture of you and your emotional makeup and what you need to get your needs met and everything that comes with it. So yeah, it's super important. Yeah.
So true.
So what role did forgiveness play? I know you're talking about how we weren't blaming parents or upbringing, but acknowledging the contribution. And did you end up needing to forgive?
Yeah, big time. So, you know, we talk about this on my podcast a lot. This is like a really, you know, hot subject because I think, again, when we're talking about like people wronging us, forgiveness is often not welcomed, you know, especially when you have somebody who has maybe sexual abuse or something like that in their story. And there's a lot of misconceptions about it. We can get into that. But for me, I would honestly say there were very few times where I had a moment where afterwards I felt a difference. Like recovery for me was like, it was success by 1,000 paper cuts. You know what I mean? It's like a little improvement here, a little improvement there. But genuinely, the only time I really remember coming out of a session, this was a session with a counselor, and they had walked me through forgiving my mom for the exact dynamic I had just labeled. And I felt different. Like my shoulders were relaxed. I felt lighter. You know, the next day I remember having a tempting thought and it just kind of passed through. I didn't have to like, you know, break it off in Jesus' name or do anything like that. It just like the stickiness wasn't there anymore. Like something had shifted. So I can't emphasize it enough. Like to us, it's the centerpiece of healing from trauma is that you reach a place of forgiveness where it's not that what they've done is okay. It's just that you are no longer allowing that to impact you negatively. And that's easier said than done, obviously. But to me, that's like, it's critical. Like without it, there's no recovery.
Yes. And so you actually have a process that you walk people through for granting forgiveness. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We have four things we walk people through. So it's identify, specify, release, and restore. And the most important part by far is the identification. It's step one. And people gloss over this, you know, because we get taught as kids, like, you know, you're mad at each other. So you look them in the eyes and you say, I forgive you, you know, even though you're still kind of bitter and resentful. And you don't say why they hurt you or anything like that, but you just say, I forgive you, and you move on. Identifying it's really uncomfortable, as we've kind of already established. It's not easy to say, like, you know, that my mom, despite her best efforts, didn't show love the way that I needed it or whatever it might be. That those are difficult things to identify. But your effectiveness in forgiving is only as effective as you are specific.
Yeah.
So you have to be able to identify and you have to specify where was the wound? Why did it hurt you? And once you do that, then the other parts are easy. You know, releasing it, the way we summarize releasing it is you owe me nothing. You owe me nothing. That's like kind of the sentiment. It's there's no keeping records of accounts. I'm not expecting anything from this. It's a full release. And then restoration. And, you know, restoration looks different for everyone. For me, I'm really fortunate. I would say I have a better relationship with my parents because of what I went through. And I was able to have some transparent conversations with them. You know, we have a lot of clients who don't want to talk to their parents, and that's totally fine. So restoring in that case maybe looks like purposing in your heart to want the best for them, you know, praying, praying blessing over them. Yep. It might start a bit smaller, but that restoration process, again, it's important. It kind of clinches everything together. So that's what it looks like for us.
That's really good.
That is really good. You mentioned a little bit ago, and I think it's just helpful to talk about because a lot of people deal with it. But like when you forgave your mom, you walked out of the session, you had a tempting thought and you just let it go pass through you. Can you talk about that? Because a lot of people have a difficult time being aware of their thoughts.
Yeah.
And how to treat them. Like, how do I feel about a tempting thought? What do I do with it? And then also, how to report that? You know, there's a lot of spouses who want to hear their tempting thoughts. They're like, I don't even know which ones to open up about because they happen all the time. And I don't want her to think I'm a monster.
Yeah, man, it's such a good question. And the lines are different for everyone. Here's what I will say for sure regarding thoughts. And this is the most helpful way I can think to articulate it. Every thought is a seed. It takes root when you agree with it. It grows as you repeat it, and it bears fruit when you act on it. And so just because you had a thought means very little. It's what happens after the thought that matters. You know, I am at the gym pretty regularly, and I find that I'm the most tempted at the gym because I'm often the most stimulated by tempting things at the gym. Mm. Those are not thoughts that I'm vocalizing to my wife all the time. Although I do tell her sometimes, like, yeah, the gym can be really difficult. You know, she's aware of that. Yeah. But earlier in my recovery, earlier after I had recovered, and my wife and I were just dating at the time. I remember there was one particular day I was really stressed and I was just feeling the stress in my body, you know, and I had all these thoughts of like, I need to go watch porn. And I had probably been clean for 18, 24 months at that point. So I had really made like a lot of progress. And it was unusual for me to have a day like this. And we had date night that night. My wife and I were just dating. We were the couple, like we decided not to kiss while we were dating. So we had pretty strict boundaries. And I remember just thinking like, I don't know what I'm going to do because this is not a good situation. You know, like the recipe for disaster is like clear as day here. So I pick her up and we're going back to my place. And because, you know, I think I had an apartment or maybe I was renting a room, but we were going back to my place. And just as she's getting out of the car, I was like, oh, duh, talk about it. You know, like obviously. So I was like, hey, babe, before you get out, I've had a really hard day. I've been feeling really tempted to watch pornography. And I just wanted to let you know, cause I'm a little bit nervous that I'm going to compromise our boundaries tonight. And she just had the biggest look of like biggest smile on her face. And she was like, hey, don't worry. I'll pick up the slack tonight. You know, like no harm, no foul. And I learned out of that, I would rather confess a temptation than confess a mistake. And so just because you have a thought, I don't think that's much to worry about. When it becomes a temptation, that's when you have to consider it. And I think if you are in a relationship, you should have some established lines of what gets communicated and what doesn't. And that's sort of the second filter that decides whether or not this temptation gets reported.
So like when the temptation, the seed finds ground.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you're actually kind of worrying on it, it's found root.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I would say so. Once it starts to return again, you know, once it's maybe consuming more of you, like as it's starting to develop, I think that's when that should send off the alarm bells. Like, I need to talk to someone about it. If it's not your spouse, then, you know, have somebody else that you're talking to. But yeah, I think that's the point where it's got to be brought out into the light.
I love that. That's really good. Do you have your guys in your groups? Do you have them specify the exact language of their thoughts or the most common ideas?
Yeah, we always try to understand like what their spouse or what their partner's asked for first, because that obviously dictates the nature of it. Mm. But our general principle is like, only detail where requested. So like, it's one thing to say, like, I feel tempted to watch porn. I'm not talking about like, I don't know, the sites or the nature of it. You know what I mean? It's probably not relevant. And the other thing you have to ask yourself is, why are you communicating this? Because once you know why you're communicating it, that should make it pretty clear what needs to be said and what doesn't. Mm-hmm. If I'm communicating this for the sake of transparency, so I can have a healthier connection with my wife, which, you know, generally is going to be the case. The transparency is in I had the temptation, or, you know, or I'm having these flashbacks with my ex. But the details of it don't really I don't think they really help the connection unless they're concerning maybe a specific issue we've been discussing and whatever. Like, there's always exceptions to it, but you want to just have your main purpose in mind and let that influence what you share and to what degree.
Mm. Yeah.
Sound
like
advice.
That's a good filter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in your program, and we'll talk more about your program here at the end too, and share so people can find out how to get in touch with you. But in your program, I'm sure you deal with the dynamics of millennials and the dynamics of Gen Z, and probably, you know, Gen X as well, like everything in between. But talk a little bit about the differences you see when it comes to porn recovery for millennials versus Gen Z.
Yeah, the differences are pretty stark. So for millennials, it's interesting because I know the three of us are all millennials. So weren't born into technology, right? But then had it like in maybe the teenish years, and would have had exposure to pornography. I think back then the average age was maybe 10 to 12 years old, maybe even a little bit older. Mm-hmm. Millennials are like notorious for promiscuity, so very promiscuous. And I think getting into technology, having all that access to pornography really fueled that promiscuity. There were other things at play as well. But I think that factored in. And so when we work with millennials, there's a lot of like teaching commitment that sort of comes with it and what commitment really means at a heart level, not just, you know, in your behavior. And I think that's just because of the times that we grew up in where it was like, wow, we have all these opportunities and all these options just at our fingertips. Hmm. I think with Gen Z, it's different because they grew up in it. Promiscuity is actually a lot lower in Gen Z. And there's a couple reasons for that. I think what's relevant for this conversation is number one, pornography is very normal for Gen Z. Their exposure would have been a lot younger. And it's very common. It's very mainstream. You know, like these porn sites get billions of hits a day. There's only 8 billion people in the world. There's a real like commonality to it. But I think the second thing with Gen Z that people don't talk about a lot is the way the content has changed. And so there's a researcher out of New Zealand. Her name is Jo Robertson. She did a survey of mainstream pornography. This is about 3 years ago, I believe. Okay. And what she found is that about 80% of videos on any mainstream site depict scenes of violence and aggression, usually towards the woman. So the nature of what people think sex is, like, and Gen Z in particular, is totally different. And so I think when they go through the recovery process, it's a lot more about like, you know, it's a lot more about changing their views on sex itself, and everything that sort of comes with it and what healthy sexuality really is. I think that concept's been a lot more attacked for Gen Z than it has for millennials. So those are the two big things we notice. We serve both. I would say millennials a lot more, but I would say those are probably the two big things we've noticed so far.
Wow. Mm. Why do you think Gen Z is less promiscuous, even though they've been exposed earlier and grew up in a digital pornographic world?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is that they're just accustomed to getting it digitally. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas like for millennials, we kind of like, that was a transition for us, whereas for them, that was just like the norm. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing is that there's like a lot of fear around commitment and sexual relationships at large, you know, especially with the guys that we're working with. A lot of them fall into pornography because it's just easier than having to risk rejection, trying to pursue a girl, you know, all the money that comes with it. Like dating and all those kind of like relationships romantically have been painted in this really bad light. And I think that's another huge reason for it.
That makes sense. Yeah. So they are getting married at lesser rates, but they're also just exposed to porn all the time.
Yeah. It's just more
so they're
normal.
Not having sex, but
no,
but they are exposed to porn. So that's what you mean when they're less promiscuous. They're not going out and having sex as often or at all.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. But the engagement with pornography is, I mean, sky high. You know, Gen Z accounts for a large, not a majority, but a good percentage of porn viewers. And I mean, they've been inundated with it from a young age. So
right.
And violent, which is really interesting. And that's going to be very interesting how that plays out over time.
Right. Yeah.
With
abuse.
Abuse, but maybe even how the interaction between spouses, you know, maybe they're repelled by that because they got it met there. But yeah, that would be very interesting thing to look at. Or
right. Well, Billie Eilish had an interview with Howard Stern like maybe 2 years ago now that went pretty viral. And she talked about how when she was starting to have sexual relationships, everything that she figured the guy wanted was based on what she watched in pornography, which was very violent, like really extreme. And, you know, granted, some of the, she said some of the guys that she was with were for that, and that's what they wanted. But she didn't know, like as a young girl, she didn't know that that wasn't normal, or that wasn't like healthy sexual relationships, because what she had seen and what she was exposed to, like porn was her sex teacher. And what it showed her was very violent, very aggressive. So that's kind of, that's all she knew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man, when that drive, like women outside of the bedroom, then if they've been taught that it's violent inside the bedroom, there has to be a swing outside the bedroom of like, I don't know what that would look like, but there would have to be a reaction to that. Like, this is violent. This doesn't feel good, but I'm taught this is what I should do.
Yeah, 100%. And like, again, if we were to broaden this conversation a little bit, pornography is media, right? And media has a message. And there are tons of messages around, you know, women, race, all kinds of stuff that are embedded into pornography. Probably about a year ago, I did a bit of a deep dive into racial undertones of pornography, and it was pretty disturbing. Like it's there and it's really obvious once you see it. So yeah, I would agree with you. Like, I think the obvious tie-in is where it affects the bedroom and sexual relationships, but it's a lot broader than that. Like, we're talking about worldviews, really.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, man, thank you, Jesus, for a compass.
Yeah, exactly.
Seriously. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about how people can find you, your resources. Tell us about your podcast, your program. Share about what you've built.
Yeah, yeah. So the program is called Deep Clean, but I think what I would love for your listeners to check out is our podcast. It's called Unleash the Man Within. We're a daily show. We just started answering listener Q&As with some regularity, which is lots of fun. And we've done over 700 episodes. So I think if you know, people are looking for more content and maybe something more specific to their situation, you should be able to find it there. So it's Unleash the Man Within. It's available on all major platforms. And then we're very active on Instagram as well. So they can check us out over there too if they want some more content.
Wow. Great. Okay. Well, we will put all of that in the show notes. So if folks are looking for a quick link, they can just go to the show notes for the podcast, the Deep Clean program, and your Instagram. And we encourage you guys, get the help, get the resources on board. You know, like Cynthia just said, the podcast has so many episodes. So you're bound to find something that's pretty specific to your situation.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much, guys.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you. We're going to close out this episode the way we close out all of our episodes. And that's by asking you this question. Rewind back to the beginning of your marriage. And what advice do you wish you would have received? And fill in the blank, dear young married couple.
Yeah, so dear young married couple, focus on acceptance before understanding. You know, I think a lot of people want to understand their spouse, which is very noble. But you know, for me at least, maybe this is my marriage. My wife is so different from me. I'm decades away from really understanding her, but when I can accept her,
honest,
you know, and
talk.
accept that we have differences. That's really helpful for me because it actually takes the pressure off, you know, because if I don't understand her, that can be really frustrating if that's my goal. Mm-hmm. But if my goal is just to accept her for who she is and the way God's made her, there's great peace in that, you know, and I can accept her for who she is, and understanding gets to develop the rest of my life. But I don't have to have it all understood and figured out. I just get to love her and accept her the way she is right now.
How beautiful. And that's really good advice for people trying to understand and can't understand sometimes.
Yeah, it's a thing, man. It happens.
It's true. Yeah. Thank you so much, Cynthia, for being on here and sharing your wisdom and your resources. Yes. We're excited for people to get clean and find freedom.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. And I'm excited to have you on my show in a couple of weeks. It'll be fun.
Yes, we're going to have a good time.